pleasure group. Let's see. We're going to start eating or what, Prusa? Okay, we're going to have the invocation for Father John O'Neill.
My name is John, and I'm an alcoholic. I should say welcome to everybody, but it's not my home, so you're welcoming me. We bless this evening, not just the meal, but we bless the friendships here. We bless the sobriety here. We bless our families, our friends, all who have supported us to get us to this night where we all look so good, are able to sit up straight on chairs and so forth. We ask the higher power to continue to bless us one day at a time. And we ask this in the name of our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. Amen.
I certainly want to thank all of you for coming. You made this the fair for us, for our group. I'm going to ask Michael to start off and read how it works.
Where'd that come from?
If you hear any of these icky ickies over some stickies left over from the last conference.
Hi, everybody. My name is Michael Rich, and I'm powerless over alcohol.
Doc, wait, but just before you go, we'd like to, I'd like everybody to give Doc a little hand. This is his 31st anniversary sober. We got a little coin for you, Doc. Okay, this is how it works. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our directions. Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program. Usually men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. There are such unfortunates. They are not at fault. They seem to have been born that way. They are naturally incapable of grasping and developing a way of life which demands rigorous honesty. Their chances are less than average. There are those, too, who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders, but many of them do recover if they have the capacity to be honest. Our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we are like now. If you have decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you are ready to follow directions. At some of these, you may balk. You may think you can find an easier, softer way. We doubt if you can. With all the earnestness that our command, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. Some of us have tried to hold on to our old ideas, and the result was nil until we let go absolutely. Remember that you are dealing with alcohol, cunning, baffling, and powerful. Without help, it is too much for you. But there is one who has all power. That one is God. You must find him now. Half measures will avail you nothing. You stood at the turning point. Throw yourself under his protection and care with complete abandon. Now we think you can take it. Here are steps we took, which are suggested as your program of recovery. Number one, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives became unmanageable. Two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care and direction of God as we understood him. Four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Six, we were entirely willing that God remove all these defects of character. Seven, humbly on our knees, asked him to remove our shortcomings, holding nothing back. Eight, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make complete amends to them all. Nine, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our contact with God, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. 12, having had a spiritual experience as a result of this course of action, we tried to carry this message to others, especially alcoholics, and to practice these principles in all our affairs. You may exclaim, what an order. I can't go through with it. Do not be discouraged. No one among us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. We are not saints. The point is that we are willing to grow along spiritual lines. The principles we have set down are guides to progress. We claim spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection. Our description of the alcoholic, the chapter to the agnostic, and our personal adventures before and after have been designed to sell you three pertinent ideas. A, that you are alcoholic and cannot manage your own life. B, that probably no human power can relieve your alcoholism. C, that God can and will. If you are not convinced of these vital issues, you ought to reread the book to this point or else throw it away.
There you go, Doc. For those who don't know, that's the original manuscript before 1938 when the big book was redrawn up when Bill and Bob got together. At this time, I certainly want to thank those who helped sell the tickets for this affair, because I'm sure that Tony and I did the work, a lot of the work here, could never do it without three people. So I want to thank the ticket sellers and thank all of you who came. Now we're getting down to our lead. I'll tell you what happened. He drove in from St. Louis today, and that's a long drive. And it's a good thing he's young. But at 4 o'clock, he wasn't here yet. And I went to the bed, and I laid down, and I said the rosary. And at 5... There's Stacy. We'll take it. Bill. There'll be tapes over there if you want. There'll be tapes right there. And at 5:30, just as I woke up, I got up and I started writing for the backup speaker, see? And I put the ticket, the name down there, who I was going to get for the backup speaker. So you got to be glad because you're not hearing the Scotchman with the brogue, you know? But he got here, and his problem was that time was different. St. Louis's time is an hour different than ours. So I said a few prayers, and he got here safe. You see, prayers work. But we met him last year at a retreat. He was the retreat master down in Kentucky, and we've been going to Kentucky now for better than 24, 25 years. And this year was the first time he was our retreat master. And we liked what he had to say, and I figured maybe you would like what he had to say, too. Most of the time, Tony is going to... This is new to Tony, because he meditates a lot when people talk, with his eyes closed, you know. And especially if he talks early in the morning. So he's a meditator. But anyhow, I want to give you Father John O'Neill from St. Louis, Missouri. Father John O'Neill...
O ye of little faith. Why, when there's a chance to speak and you're a drunk, wouldn't you show up? I got up at 4:15 this morning to be here. Came through all kinds of horrendous things. Cost me $5 for breakfast on the road. Terrible things. Butterflies flew out of my wallet. My name is John, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm very, very happy and grateful to be here and feel very humble, especially to be at something associated with this great lady, Sister Ignatia. She's a heroine, much unsung, really. Was very happy at my natural birthday a couple of weeks ago to be given her new biography, which I'm in the midst of reading. Was significant that I was going to be coming here, too, at the same time. That lady did an awful lot for our forefathers and for us, and her legacy lives on in all of you. I'm here because I'm not all there. I will tell you a little bit about myself for purposes of identification, not to bore you and not to give you a drunkologue. You've all been through those, or you've all given them to yourselves. So I don't want to do that to you. I thank Don very much for asking me. I know that I gave him some problems trying to find me and make sure I was still a priest and hadn't run away. You know, the priesthood is a tough racket today. If you read the papers, you never know what's going to happen next and who's going to be sued and so forth and so on. There's few good ones like us left. We did all the bad stuff years ago and came to this program and are in the process of trying to get healthy or at least stabilized. I was born in a little town called Bethlehem. My mother's name was Mary and my father's name was Joseph. And there was a star out that night. Or so I believed for many years. And my mother reinforced it, as a good Irish Catholic mother would do. And it took, and it's still in process. I'm 52 years old, where he gets off saying, I'm young. I'm looking forward to an early retirement. All these years it's taken to find out that I am one of many, not unique. I'm one of a group. I'm one of the family of humankind. And trying hard each day to accept that and to understand that about myself. And not to be this singular, unique person over here who has special problems and special gifts and special this and special that and special uniqueness and on and on and on it goes. That gets very boring to everybody after a while. The charitable thing about AA is that, at least in the beginning of your time in the program, they're kind enough to at least listen to you with all your uniqueness and all your unique problems. And they still even seem to be listening long after it wears off. But that's, you don't find those people around too much. You can't do that in church. You can't do that with a group of priests because no one has time for it. We have to learn how to take care of ourselves, how to deal with whatever difficulties, but also whatever gifts God has given to us. And we both share equally in all of those things, gifts and the ups and downs of life. That's part of living. At any rate, the growing up experience was in New York City, the son of a New York City policeman. Grew up in a place called Queens, where the Mets attempt to play ball at Shea Stadium. There was nothing very significant except that from very early on I had it in my head as the oldest son in a family of four children that I was to be the best, the brightest, the winner, and nothing else would do. Now, I don't think my parents told me that, but somewhere along the line I got that into my head to do that, and life became this obsessive yearning for perfection, and therefore an obsessive yearning for perfection usually turns into a long life of complaining and whining because perfection isn't there, and it's not about to be, not in this life anyway. So, after being told for a significant number of times in the first 21 years of my life that you're boring, I finally went away to the seminary, thinking I'd get a new audience who would listen to all this. But in a short order, they told me even quicker than the family did. The family was very loving. They gave me everything they could possibly give me, and to all of their children, good education, good home life. There were difficulties, and I'll tell you some of that later on, but in the difficulties even, they were always together as a family, and we knew each one of us, their children. They're both dead now, my mother and father, but each one of us children knew that we belonged to them and that we were loved and we were cared about. When I went to the seminary, I had completed going to a Jesuit high school in New York and 2 years of St. John's University. The seminary in those days, I went when Lincoln was president, long time ago. The seminary was not anything like today. Before I had my present position in St. Louis, I lived in a seminary in Washington, D.C. for 10 years, and there's nothing except the physical plant itself that resembles the seminary that we went to 30 years ago, when before JFK was shot, before anyone heard of Oliver Stone. I was in a seminary. It was all in Latin. We got up at 5 o'clock in the morning. Some other snot-nosed seminarian went through the hall with a handbell, banging it away, saying in Latin, Bene dicamus domino, and you were supposed to say Deo gratias, which meant thanks be to God for the new day, and you usually were saying bullshit, you know, because it was 5 o'clock in the morning. It was awful. Awful. And then the torture began, because the day was broken into half hour, 20 minutes, 45 minute segments through the whole day until at 9:45 at night, the rector pulled the master switch and the whole place went into darkness. You could be dressed, undressed, taking a shower, in the bathroom, studying, didn't matter. It was God's will that that damn light had to go out at 9:45 because he was going to go to bed. So 225 other people had to go to bed too. Unless you were more creative like I was and had a flashlight under the covers and eventually a night lamp. So there isn't much to say about the seminary that, except in my way, in my stupid way, I did okay in the seminary. I had no problem getting along. I had no problem with the system as it was set up in those days because there was nothing to think about. Our whole day was taken up and we were away all the time. We rarely got home. But I did know about my little friend Booz. I knew about Booz because I came from an Irish family. And the Irish cop drank with other Irish cops and got tootled sometimes to the extent of firing the gun off in the backyard, you know, for the edification of the neighbors on occasion, who couldn't say anything because he was the cop on the block. He'd like to shoot them. So in going to the seminary, I knew about Booz, and many of my classmates did too. So as the seminary progressed, years went by, 3-4 years, as I was getting closer to being a priest, I got braver and took more chances. And we had occasions, they sound silly now looking back at it, to even say this to a group of adults, but we did things like we went out to teach catechism to the kids who weren't blessed enough to go to a Catholic school, who had to suffer through the Protestant school, as our rector used to say, the public school system. And we would go out to try to convert these little infidels on Wednesday afternoons. But that was my occasion to go to the state store in Pennsylvania to sneak across the state line to get booze. I whipped the collar off, and I have a polo shirt on underneath, and I'd run in. I'm sure this guy was wondering who this skinny, stupid idiot was who ran in and bought 2 bottles of scotch every 2 weeks by all the money that we pooled through our card games in the seminary. Now, this was not the whole seminary. This was only a bad group that I hung out with. A minority. All of whom are still priests today. All the others went. All the others went and got married. We're the only ones who are still there because there's free room and board and three squares a day, as you can see. And a very good pension plan. In doing this, I got away with it for a period of 2 years in the seminary, and I was to with 1 year of being ordained a priest. I had already been ordained a subdeacon, which we don't even have that in the church anymore. But that was the preliminary step to becoming a deacon, which we still have. So all I had to do was become a deacon and a priest. Subdeacon was so important in those days that that was when you actually took the vow of celibacy, when you promised not to marry. It was important enough that we also had to start reading the office on a daily basis, the priest's breviary every day. That's how important this was. It was when we could wear a Roman collar all the time. We were as close to getting to be priests as we could possibly get. And that's when I chose to do my number. I was out doing business for the seminary one day, a snowy day, in early March, in 1956, the year that Sister died. And on that snowy day, I picked up 4 bottles instead of 2 bottles. And I did the business that I was supposed to do, and I was in the rector's brand new Fairlane, or something like that, some 60s model Ford that he had just gotten. And he loved his car, even though he was a poor Franciscan, he was attached to his car. And the car stayed in a garage underneath his room. He slept on top of the car. Not on the roof of the car. He slept in a bed in a room over the car. And he was a kind of a bird-like man. He didn't sleep too well and jumping and so forth. And I came in too late. I had had a few snorts out of the bottle because I figured we had four. There was still plenty to go around. And I came in feeling no pain. And I skidded on a patch of ice. And I whacked the car into the garage on the side, both sides. I went in like I was doing a dance instead of going in straight. Bang, bang. And I knew that his nibs would be downstairs quick as a bunny. So I quickly backed the car back out and hit it again. Whirled the thing around to God knows where. It was pitch black. This was upstate New York. Couldn't see anything. And I couldn't see anything if it was light because I was feeling too good. But I was going to hide out until he went back to bed. Of course, I did the most appropriate thing is I passed out. And I stayed passed out until daylight, early in the morning, in the car. And the next thing I know is his nibs is wrapping on the side window. I had foresight enough to lock the car, lock myself into the car. So he couldn't get into the car because I had his keys. And he's knocking in his brown Franciscan robe in the freezing cold on a cold March day. He's knocking on the window with a kind of a frantic, hysterical look on his face, blood red under his white, snowy thatch of hair. And in the background were 40 Nazi sisters. 40 nuns who had escaped Germany and were sent to torture us in the seminary. And they were all standing there with their arms folded with that self-righteous, smug look that they had. They finally got you. He finally got you. We told him before, you were a son of a bitch. Now he knows. And I was gone. Not only was I asleep in his car, but I had spilled one whole bottle all over his upholstery. He probably had to buy a new car. It was so bad. I was sent home, and I went home, and my family was not well pleased. I was kicked out of the seminary. Now, that's hard to do looking back at that time. You don't have to know that. I'm just telling you that that was a very, very... To be kicked out at that particular point is like having already gotten your diploma at West Point, and they put the little things on your shoulder and gave you your diploma and hat and your assignment, and then you screw up immediately. This is what basically it came down to. Because not only did they kick me out of the seminary, the diocese that I was studying for, the bishop sent to Rome and had me, the phrase was, reductio ad legem. Now you can go and think about that for a while. Reduced to the lay state. And all you people here are lay people, basically. So you're all reduced. That's what the church thinks of you. You're a reductio to begin with. Now I was being put in with you. Church has always been a little grandiose. Not by some Montigny over there. When I went down to the chancery office and signed the papers that had to be signed, in which I agreed never, ever, ever to approach the seminary, attempt to study to be a priest either in that diocese or any other diocese in the United States or any religious order, period. I came out and I did the right and proper thing. I got blotto. And I stayed blotto for 4 whole years after that. And I mean blotto, because I went through... There's so many segments of that period of time from age 25 to 29 that I can't remember. They're just blackouts. Waking up in the street, waking up in people's houses, people I didn't know, people walking into their living room and finding me on their couches, and
Obviously, they had had a few, too, and they're saying, who is this? You know,
Did you bring him home?
No, I didn't bring him home. Would you leave, please, before breakfast? I woke up one morning in the Hamptons. The Hamptons is a resort area. I had started drinking on 3rd Avenue in the east side of Manhattan, and I had gone 100 miles in a Volkswagen Beetle to the Hamptons, and I was now sleeping on some 82-year-old woman's couch on the beach. And she was saying to me in her bathrobe and slippers that she was going to take care of me the rest of my life. And I knew there was something wrong. This was not social drinking. Mother was right. There was a problem here. In the meantime, my father, who ruled with an iron hand, my father rose to what's called an inspector in the New York City Police Department. That's like a guy who's in charge of a whole borough. New York City is 5 boroughs. So my father had terminal grandiosity because he had eagles on everything, his pajamas, his bathrobe, his little flag on his car. Came home with a siren every night. Two shell-shot chauffeurs. They used to take cops who weren't allowed to carry their guns anymore and make them the chauffeurs for these guys. So he had these people driving him home with him screaming, put the siren on, I'm not going to sit in this goddamn traffic waiting to get home. Put the siren on. Ready? And Freddy's banging his head on the window, praying that he can get him home and get away from this madman. Because my father wanted to get home to have his one drink. At any rate, my mother called a halt to this. Some rotten person took her to an Al-Anon meeting, and she found out that she didn't have to live like this with this crazy person who had 6 guns and no head. So she got 2 priests, 2 old-timers in AA, and 2 real good ones, not 2 lobby-da priests who, you know, came in right from the rectory into the treatment center, never got a thing dirty, never threw up. No, if they threw up, sister wiped it right off before they were seen. These were 2 real scumbags. These were 2 guys who were chaplains in World War II who didn't come home. One showed up in the bishop's office in 1951, and one showed up in 1954. Luckily, the bishop in the case with the same bishop was a drunk himself. And just said, my goodness, Father, you've been missed. And promptly assigned them to parishes in Brooklyn. They were the 2 that Mother got, took them into the hospital where my father was going through his 88th withdrawal from chronic arthritis, whatever the drunken police surgeon was who he drank with every day, who would put him in when the shakes got too bad and he had to get cleaned up. And my mother said, you're going to stop drinking, Johnny. And Johnny looked at her like, have you gone mad? Because not only was she saying this, but she had these 2 outsiders breaking into the family circle that he kept such a tight thing on. Loyalty, loyalty, loyalty. We are the O'Neills. Bunch of drunks. Lo and behold, the one priest, my father said to my mother, you shut up. You know, something fresh like that. And the one priest was on him like a tiger. 72 years old. Right around the throat. He said, you stupid, shanty son of a bitch. You talk to her like that after what she's put up with. Who do you think you are? You're worth, and I won't say it. You can imagine it. And he said, if you don't go with me to an AA meeting tonight, I'm going down to the PC's office at 9 a.m. tomorrow morning, and I'm going to tell him that the guy who runs Brooklyn is a drunk. And in New York, that meant you lose all that rank, and you go down to your civil service rank of captain, you lose your gun, never get a command again, a whole lot of money, pension, everything. So the brain damage hadn't gone too far.
for El Cid. Because he went to the first AA meeting. And these two wise asses were smart. They brought him to the right AA meeting. Because he who thought he was so unique, Daniel went to an AA meeting where there were four other priests, two Christian brothers, three assistant DAs, one civil court judge, one Supreme Court judge, and also a deputy mayor of the city. So my father was the leaf in the whole room. He was just a police inspector. And he had a weird identity, and he never had a problem, and he lived on for 22 years until he died in successful recovery. And for that, we are very blessed. I'm not saying that in a bad way about my father. I often made fun of him to his face, even when he was dying in the hospital, because he would laugh. He could laugh, and he liked to laugh at himself and all of us. But he led the way, because now I'm in AA, my brother is in AA, three of my cousins are in AA, an uncle, who was his brother-in-law, who's dead also, was in AA. So while we still have a lot of active drunks running around, we also have been very, very blessed by AA. And only by AA. Not by the Catholic Church, not by the New York City Police Department, not by the Irish Rates, not by the surrender of Russia, nothing. By AA, AA. Without AA, we have nothing. At least this alcoholic says that. Everything starts with AA. When I finally decided to throw in the towel, I went home and I had to ask for my room back. Little bit. And since he was in AA approximately 2 or 3 years at that point, he had deemed himself the successor to Bill Wilson, who was dying at that time. And he sat in his throne chair in his living room, in a chair with his big trusty German Shepherd right next to him, named Sarge, by the way. And my mother sat in a lower chair where she belonged because she was a woman. And the two priests who had been involved with him sat on the couch, and I sat in the witness box over there. Remember, he was always at top. And he had a whole thing, a yellow legal thing, of how I would now live my life. And I had to swallow in spite of being that sick and that unhappy and that upset with myself, I had to swallow my pride and say, yes, I surrender. I will do it. Even though I didn't believe it at that moment. I was thinking, while he was reading all this, I was thinking how good a sledgehammer would go over his head or an axe through his neck. Quick, swift. And he took me to an AA meeting that night. I ate a bologna sandwich, first food I had had in about 5 or 6 days, and I went to an AA meeting that night. I said, aren't we rushing this a bit? Couldn't we ease into it? No, gotta go. When you gotta go, you gotta go. And I got in the car with him, in his car, with his damn dog, the dog was probably queer, because the dog hung on him like he was attached to him. His paws hung over his shoulders, and he slobbered all over him. And then if you got in the next seat, you got slobbered over, and you were supposed to love this, because he did. He loved this attention. And we went to this Protestant church. A Protestant church we went to. And he stopped the car, and I said, what's this? And he said, this is AA. This is where I was a Cub Scout, Dad. This is where I was a Boy Scout. Because we didn't, in my days, I'm so old, we didn't have Catholic Boy Scouts, but we weren't allowed. Boy Scouts was a Protestant organization. In Brooklyn, anyway. He said, just come on, get out of the car, let's go. And the dog goes, no, you can't go. Stay there. I'd be glad to sit here and let the dog go. Not only couldn't we go into the upstairs, we had to go into the cellar of the Protestant church, where the drunks went. And we went down into this basement and opened the door, and here's all these fools screaming, laughing. Laughing. Nuts. And you couldn't see them because it was a sea of smoke. It was like London or something. An absolute fog in those days. We didn't have all the health hazards we have today. And he brought me over and he said, this is your sponsor. And he introduced me to some guy
when you're 29, everybody looks like they're 89. He probably was my age that I am now. And he said, Max will be your sponsor. And then he walked away into the fog, into his own little group in the back of the room of Caps. Big group, Bayside Queens, Bayside group. Old, old group. And then Max took over. And Max, he had a lot to say. Because Max never shut up. Now that we have all this treatment jargon and we're CACs and CBCs and CBCs and everything else that we alcoholics have aspired to, myself included, very much so. Max would be called probably a manic depressive at this time because he just talked on and on without the lithium. He just on and on. It was like he had cranked himself up and you got the whole thing. He was Jewish, for one thing. I said that's a liar because I knew as a good Catholic that Jewish people do not drink. So I said, he's got to be a liar. He knew the book, the big book. He had it memorized. Literally memorized. He gave you whole big paragraphs of this thing. You know, you wanted to put a knife in his mouth. Shut up, Max. Stop. You wondered what was going to become of you if you had to go to the bathroom or something. Because he kept you in a vice-like grip by the arm. And he showed you the slogans. And then we sat for the meeting. Finally, there was quiet. Finally, he was going to be quiet. When I got sober, I only had one pair of pants left. And they were kind of a dirty gray. And Max gave me a cup of coffee, which he called coffee. It was a styrofoam cup with something gray and liquid in it, and which he promptly spilled half of it on these pants, the only pants I had left, which had no fly. They had three safety pins holding it together. And it was literally bleeding to death. And I'm sitting there with my pants all wet, and he's still whispering, my father was getting evil even for all the things I had ever done from day one with this madman, this mad escapee. He had escaped from one of Hitler's concentration camps. And my response was, well, thank you very much. But I don't need you. But I did need him. Max is dead now, long dead. But Max is a very great man. Because without all the commandments, without all the theology of any religion, Max had put together in his own difficult life, filled with difficulties, Max had put together a tremendous program based on the higher power, his understanding of the higher power, which is exactly what our founders had invited each of us to do. Not what somebody else's definition was, but to come here and to seek the higher power in our own way and resolve that issue within ourselves to our own comfortability, for our own peace and serenity, for our own long-lasting sobriety. But I can't go on to tell you all the wonderful things he did. I'm just telling you what the worst was, namely the first night, because the meeting also sunk. He said, I would love the meeting, and I probably made up in my crazy drunken mind, I'll hate the meeting, and I did hate it to this day. But they had three ladies from Scarsdale, which is up in Westchester County. Now, if you live in Queens or Brooklyn, that's blue collar. Westchester is where the hoity-toities live, or they think they're hoity-toity. So they had come down and they had crossed over the white stone bridge at the blue collar Queens from their palatial homes up in Scarsdale to give us a meeting. Three ladies with blue hair. Still sacks that they have in your shopping bags. And they sat up on the platform and they gave their talk at an open meeting. And I didn't hear any of it, mainly because he was going in my ear, and I was worried about the mess on my pants and uncomfortable in it. The only word I got out of it was something, and I was wondering, what the crap are they talking about? They're so grateful. For what? Three fools.
I'm wasting my time here. I'm such an important person. Bachelor of Arts in Latin and Greek. Minor in domestic philosophy. And here I am sitting listening to these three fools. They all got back into their Lincoln Continental and went back up to Scarsdale, never to be seen again. They had done their fish to humanity and had come to Queens. In time, AA, in a very short time, AA became my whole life. Well, literally my whole life. I had no job record. I had lost 25 jobs. I had wrecked two cars. I had smashed up a truck. I couldn't get a job. I got a job as a paperboy, basically. I was in charge of delivering newspapers for the old Long Island Press in the Coney Island section of Brooklyn. You know, a guy who takes them in a bundle and throws them off the truck on the corner. That's what I did for the first months in AA, because there were no, you didn't have to have any references. You just could walk in off the street, and I did that 7 days a week, and I went to a meeting every night and twice on Sunday. I had three sponsors, lots of telephone calls, loved it. And eventually, by some miracle, which is too long to get into tonight, I went to a meeting in this what we call the city. If you live in New York City or you grow up in New York City, Manhattan is the city. The rest of it is outside the city. So when we would say we would go to the city, we're going into Manhattan. So I went into Manhattan for a meeting one night. And after the meeting, I met an old lady with white hair. Lovely, lovely lady. Really first class, classy. With many years of sobriety. I didn't know who she was. She just walked up to me and she said, why don't you come to my office someday and see me? You know. I was just like, my God, is this the lady from the Hamptons? You know. So I went to see her, and at that time she was late 70s, and she had been in AA since 1940, 41 at that point, about 30 years. And she was the director of the intergroup office for AA in New York. Her name was Doris. And she had at one time worked for Bill at General Services. And I went to work for her running the hospital desk. And I really learned an awful lot about myself, but I learned an awful lot about AA and our history. And met a lot of wonderful, wonderful people, as I had already met, but more. It really expanded my horizon as to what this disease was about, to how it touches lives, and to how significant it was in the lives of other people involved with the individual who suffers from the disease. And soon after I was, in those days, we didn't have alcoholism councils like we have them today with state certification and so forth. You were just kind of picked and dubbed by a chief drunk, you were named Sir Knight Drunk. And you became an alcoholism counselor, and I got picked for one of those programs. One of the first programs to get the money from the federal government from the Hughes deal. They gave millions of dollars away in the early 70s for these programs. And hospitals competed for this, for beds. But it was the first time that beds were opened up on a wide scale for alcoholics in this country. And I went to work in this hospital, and I worked mainly with street people for a couple of years, and I loved it. Again, I loved it. And it taught me, I always have believed anything that I've done with AA or connected to alcoholism has always given me far more than anything I could possibly give, because I always came away learning and loving a little bit better, a little bit more. One day, when I was well into this job, enjoying my life and everything was fine, I was 32 years old, I guess, at this point, and the bishop of the diocese where I lived called our office on the phone and asked to speak to me and said, Johnny, this was not the bishop who threw me out, this was his successor. He said, Johnny, are you still interested in being a priest? And I said, just right off the top of my head, I said, yes, bishop, but I said it would be too difficult. It would be too many commitments to break and too much to give up. Well, you think about it. Here's the deal. And you let me know what you want to do. The deal was, number one, if I would go back to the seminary of his choosing, not to our own diocesan seminary, in other words, someplace that didn't know me, Secondly, that I would stay sober during the time that I was there. Thirdly, that I would pay the tuition myself, which is not the usual way. Fourthly, that I would get a master's degree in theology so that I would be equipped like the other priests. And last, that I would be patient and do it his way instead of my way. Now, he was a fine Italian man who just died last year, and I would call us. It has to be right now. When I was at the end of 71 coming in here today, I was pushing them all. Pushing them. They were not going fast enough. I had been in this car for 11 hours, and these people around looking at the trees and the shrubs and so forth, enjoying the Labor Day weekend, and they didn't understand that Mr. Importance was arriving here, star drunk, talking to the other drunks here in Cleveland, and they were in my way. That's my understanding of patience after almost 22 years in this program. So I have a long way to go. But the bishop understood it. And to make a long story short, I did all those things, and he went to Rome and appealed the case, and so I have another piece of paper that says I am raised up from your lousy state. The laser. I have to stay with this one's not working. Is it? Oh. Shut up and do your job. Don would have made a good pastor. The place would have been very clean. Or else. He was able to reverse it, and he ordained me a deacon in his own house in Brooklyn. Threw a party for my family, and a lot of healing came out of all of that for everybody, because my parents were not happy when I went back to the seminary. I had a steady girl at that point who was in the program. Luckily she's married now, not to me, has four children, but my mother was not happy about my giving her up to choose this other thing, where my mother said I would surely be drunk again, like they all are. And my father was not happy because he just wasn't happy about it. Ordination to priesthood came 6 months after that, and all of this was a very healing, wonderful thing for our family. And even though today, these many years later, I'm still remarkably grateful being a priest and would never want to be anything else, and I wonder how I would have been able to live my life if I wasn't, even with all the trouble we have in the church today, even with all the trouble in the priesthood we have today. I still, for myself, this is my choice, and that I was given the gift to be able to make that choice again, given the freedom to do that. That's what sobriety means. That's what sobriety means. I tried to tell that to the bishop a few years before he died. I don't know whether he understood it. He said, yeah, it's a good John. That's good. Keep talking. It does you good. Keep talking. I sleep a while. My mother died 6 months after I was ordained, at the age of 62, from bone cancer. But each of those days, I was able to be with her, because I was in a parish in Queens right near her, so I could go every day, especially when she was housebound, and say Mass for her and do a lot of other things for her. At least I know in a little bit, in those 6 months, I was able to give her something back of what she gave to us. My mother, I don't know whether she ever knew anything about AA, because she went to meetings. She never went to Al-Anon. She went to that one time, found out what to do, did it, and that was the end of it. But for the rest of her life, she read the 24-hour day book with her novena book every day. Why, I don't know. She liked it. I have her 24-hour day book. She went to a meeting once in a while with my father. I guess to make sure he was still going. And when she was dying, she said, take care of him. And we did until he died. And he was sober until he died. I gave my parents a hard time. What I realize now, and why I say that about Bethlehem and the Star, is that I was not a deprived childhood. I was a spoiled son of a selfish so-and-so. That's what I was. Given way too much. Listened to too much. Way too self-important for my own good. Didn't realize that I was significant in the eyes of the higher power, Almighty God, but just average. Very hard for addictive people to become average or to know about being average. We all know in the back of our heads somehow, yeah, that's right. However, I have these few things here that I don't make any difference. Let him drone on. But we are. We're trying to be average. We're trying to be part of humankind, the human family. And that, I'm so grateful that opportunity came so that I could offer some of that, at least for a portion of their lives, to my mother and father. And have been able to do it with my sister, my brother, and my five nieces today. The bishop was very wise. He kept me in a parish for only a short time. Within a year of being ordained, I was sent out to St. Louis for my first hitch to a treatment center run for priests in St. Louis, Missouri, priests suffering from alcoholism, where I got my official CAC diploma. Here, you're a certified drunk now. Congratulations. And pay us $60 every year and we'll redo it. You won't have to take the test again. Yes, sir. Another rip-off. So I worked there for 2 years with priests, carried a full patient load, enjoyed every minute of it, met a lot of crazy guys, I've met a lot of wonderful guys, and learned more, again, about myself. And then after that, when the 2 years were up, I was supposed to go back to Brooklyn, but instead I got picked to be director of the National Clergy Council on Alcoholism in Washington, which was founded, some of you may know, by Father Ralph Fow, Father John Doe, who wrote the Golden Books, the Golden Tapes, the first known priest in AA back in the late 40s. Father John Doe was Father Ralph Fow of Indianapolis. And he had started this institution that eventually was given the blessing and credibility of the church and is an official organization of the Bishops' Conference in Washington. So for 10 years, from 81 to 91, I was the Pope of the Drunks. The Pope's man in alcohol. And it was fun because I got to go to the White House a couple of times. They'd stop, you know, walk through all those things and make sure you don't have guns. Watch Ronald Reagan trying to slip through a talk, Nancy whispering in his ear. I still have a little coin she gave me, put in my hand, said something about stop or don't do or think or do something that she wanted done at the time. I sat next to, in one of these drug signing bills, I sat next to a guy who had all these ribbons. He looked magnificent. Epaulettes and stars and everything. The doorman from the Hotel Plaza. And I was sitting next to one of our bishops who's a pompous ass, and I got tired of his crap. So I turned to this guy to see what he had to say, and he was a very nice man in spite of all this stuff he had. He talked normal, and he just gave me his name, you know, something like Tom Smith, you know, John O'Neill. You know. He said, you're a priest. I said, yes, you know, this kind of, I'm like, you're a nun in drag. This is usually, this is usually what this means. So he said a few other kind, non-entity kind of things, and I said, what do you do? And he said, I'm in the Coast Guard. And I said, oh, my dad has a boat. Well, he looked like I had just farted or something. He was the commander of the U.S. Coast Guard. 40,000 people under him. You know, he was like a field marshal or something. Could have probably had me hung from the yardarm. I said, that has a boat, 16 feet. 25 horsepower motor. Big stuff. Up in Queens. Your Admiralty. Being in the church, you get used to all that, you know, with all those cardinals and everything, like O'Connor and Bedlock, or Kroll, who came from the city with a butcher's son. They take themselves seriously, you know, put that little bit of purple on. That's the real thing. Look like drag queens.
After the 10 years there, I wasn't really sure what I was going to do. The bishop who had ordained me had retired, but I had been given permission, and this will probably not make much sense, but I was given permission to enter a religious society known as the Josephites. I had lived with them for 10 years in Washington, and I knew them so well, and they're such a small group. Most of their work, most of the priests in the society, there's only about 150 of us in the whole world, devote their lives to serving the African-American part of the church. I was still allowed, even in membership, to continue working in terms of the therapy of priests. And I'll make this swift because I'm going to ask you to remember us in a special way. Last year, just a year ago, when I gave the retreat in Kentucky, I was starting out as director of this retreat house in St. Louis on a temporary basis while another guy was prepared to be the director, a Franciscan priest who was down there. But in preparing for this, we were floating a program whereby we would establish a 12-step program based on the Oxford House movement from Washington, D.C. There are 300 Oxford houses throughout the United States now for alcoholics, halfway houses, places that are self-governing, autonomous. It's been a very, very successful program. We've been allowed to adopt that program, and myself and my partner, another priest, who's not in the program but knows a lot about it and is very sympathetic to it, we have finally received permission from the authorities. That is, you can't just get permission from superiors and bishops anymore. You have to get permission from the lawyers because of all the lawsuits. We are going to, at the end of this month, probably when I come back from Kentucky, we will open our first halfway house for priests. But it's for priests, and I ask you to listen and to pray, because some of you may not even agree with what we're doing, but I still ask you to pray for us, because it's brand new. We are going to try to take care of those priests who have had to go to jail because of pedophilia or some other deviance. And we have our first two coming out of jail in about 2 weeks. And they can no longer practice as priests. They're forbidden by the church to say Mass or to exercise any sacramental ministry based on the fact that over the past 10 years, the church has gone through approximately $400 million in lawsuits on these cases. And much of that is justified, certainly, because the sexual abuse of a child is absolutely a horror. And when it's done by someone who is trusted, it is even more of a horror. But at the same time, these are still individuals who are in need of something and someone. And the church, we don't feel, and we finally have some agreement, that they can be just wiped away and told, get lost. You are a lost cause. We don't want you anymore. So we're starting that. That'll mean they'll have to have jobs, regular jobs outside in civilian life. We have to do our own fundraising. We have to do everything on our own, which is fine. That's challenging to me, and that's challenging to Father Burke. And it's better to have less of the bishops involved, but you still have to have their permission to do it. If you get too much of the bishops involved, and it's any success, they're always there for the pictures. So I would rather us be alone the way we're going to be. But I ask, as I've asked from other groups that I've spoken to, especially groups like this, each of us in some way has felt alone, thrown away, put aside, useless, used up, washed out,
rejected. Those are the key words with these people also. Maybe the 12 steps, which has worked so well with so many people, including ourselves, could possibly work with them if they are motivated to do this, so that they might redeem their lives in some way. Not necessarily to be what they were before, but to be something that has some self-respect, some self-esteem. That's the opportunity that we're trying to give to them. So this is a whole new thing at the age of 52. And the only way I can do that is the same way I came here tonight. Because everybody said to me yesterday, "You're going to get up and drive to Cleveland tomorrow?" The other priest I live with, "You're going to get up and drive to Cleveland tomorrow?" Like, why would you do that? I do that because I want to do that. And I can make those choices today. I do that because I'm sober and I can make those choices today. I do that because I like mornings now. The day doesn't begin at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. I get used to it. I do that because I feel free. And I want somebody else to enjoy the same thing that I have felt through these wonderful years since 1970. So God bless each of you. And more importantly, give thanks to God for each of you, because of each of you are gifts, special gifts. You possess something that a lot of other people don't possess. Therefore, there is an obligation on each one's part to offer that gift to someone else. Because the way that we keep the gift alive, the way we keep the spirit alive, the way that our two founders, Bill and Bob, learning the spiritual part primarily through Sister and Father Ed Dowling from St. Louis, the Jesuit, is to give it away and to keep giving it away, no matter how you feel, no matter how successful you may be or not be, no matter what is going on. Every day, I must offer this in some way to somebody else, because that keeps me free, and that keeps me happy, that keeps me serene, that keeps me sober. God bless you.
I certainly want to thank you. You know, you talked of